Pulling tape now, and this is on YouTube.
All right, perfect.
So, yeah, I just think he's a cartoon character that is funny to watch, and as a person who has started their own media outlet and works for a media outlet and, like, you know, working for a nationally syndicated radio show, like, I see the industry. And so I can compare, like, a lot of different people to Alex Jones, and I go, what he's been able to build off of selling vitamins that barely work is incredible.
Yeah, vitamins are important. Heck, oh my gosh.
Did you see my, I'm very medicated over there.
You have all your vitamins.
I don't have any super male vitality right now, but I've got my, L-carnitine and
right,
stuff.
You
got
to offset all that fluoride in your water. Oh, my God.
I apologize for giving you fluoridated water.
Wow, yeah. I mean, God, if I found, I would have brought my own filtered water from my Berkey system. That's B-E-R-K-E.
Please tell me you make money off of that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, like $100 every one. No, I'm totally kidding. I don't make money off of Berkey. Berkey I would sell without making money.
Really? Mm-hmm. Does it taste that much better?
It actually, you know, it's not like it's better. It's just, actually it does taste better. You know what? Yeah.
Because
when you drink like the dechlorinated water and fluorinated, is that how we say it? It actually, like, it tastes a lot fresher. Mm. And then you shower and it feels like you're in a swimming pool.
Maybe I need to look into this.
I think you do. I think this is just the thing for you. Remember, that's B-E-R, okay? And Tom Z sent you
1-800. How do you want me to call you?
Oh, call me Z. Everyone calls me Z. So that's just how it is. That's, yeah.
All right. Here, I'll play this for you.
Oh, man, I'm so excited.
The paradigm of absolute control. And that's why we're trying to do simple things, pointing out that we're meant to be in nature and be natural. And this is where we find the source that God made to transcend the new world order. And that's why they want to try to keep us out of it.
I'm angry. I've had enough of these people. Little bones of Christian murderous scum. They're on giant death factories keeping babies alive.
What is this called?
It's by Stereo Deluxe, and it's it's Alex Jones is a folk song.
Alex Jones is a folk song.
And so they've recorded over it.
Oh,
and
my God, I'm going to write this down.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
Babies.
I have them on video.
Oh, man. I'm so
Hillary's in the creepy weird six.
Is this thing recorded? Like, do we do it like live?
Yeah.
Question mark? Okay.
Seems like.
I'm sick of being social engineered. It's not funny. I'm sick of being social engineered. It's not funny.
So this is live on YouTube and it's live to tape. I will edit stuff. So like if you went back and you said something like real egregious or libel or slander or whatever, then I go and edit that stuff out. I've edited recently out in the last year out of two episodes a week ish. I've only edited out like a couple chunks just because they were real bad. They were just like. One was real over the line obscene and the other one was just boring. So I try not to edit because my feeling is that when you edit, you give yourself, I'm going to put you in the group. So then you have the notification here of the YouTube.
Perfect.
Video. You get lazy.
Mm-hmm.
And when you know it's live, and you're without a high wire, it's a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. It's live to tape. So, if you say the F word,
it's on.
There's nothing
it's
I can
on.
Do.
Everyone's hearing about it. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
And if you need to belch, then you can press that button. So, talk right now.
Okay. Talking?
See?
Oh, my.
It's magic. Yeah.
Wow. So, I can just beep out any profanities, you know? I'll just be like, oh, and then just hit the... hit the button.
Sum Ting Wong Ho Li Fook. Oh my God.
Have you ever seen that video? I have so much to show. Your parents.
Oh my gosh. I am so excited.
Were you homeschooled?
Okay, I was, yeah.
Oh no.
This is what happens. And then still, so I'm 5 years out of school and I spent a year in Germany going to a public school and a private school there.
Right.
And then 4 years in college and I still don't know what the crap people are talking about. So it really goes to show, folks, if you want your kids to be educated in
memes,
in meme culture, then make sure they're not homeschooled because they will not hear about any of this and then they'll look stupid with their friends. So,
it's so sad.
I know. I'm like way behind in the libertarian movement because of it. It's really been, you know, this is why I'm not the chair right now, is because of my...
Chair of what?
The Libertarian Party, obviously.
Oh, I know. I would vote for you.
Thank you. Wow, that's nice.
Forget you, Nick Starwark.
I know. Yeah, screw you.
All right, here we go.
All right, let's get back to some boring subjects.
Understand the risk to our country.
Freedom brings people together.
You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at wearelibertarians.com.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians. This is episode 323. My name is Chris Spangle. We're recording live on October 20th. October 20th? I don't know.
I think it's October 20th. We're good.
It's the weekend. I have no idea what's going on.
Yes.
And so we're going to talk about tariffs today. We're going to talk about the student movement within the libertarian movement. My guest is Z Hunt. We're hunting for Z's today. So we'll see.
I haven't heard that one before.
We'll see if we can find it here in just a moment. Oops.
Warning. This show is for adults, produced by semi-adults. So the language is sometimes strong and offensive.
I don't know what I said.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all of the irreverence it deserves.
There has been lie after lie.
We toss out the screaming heads, put people before political parties, and give context to the news to make you think. Now, here's our host, a 15-year veteran of politics and media, Chris Spangle.
Welcome to this episode of We're Libertarians. Again, my name is Chris Spangle. You're joining us live to tape. If you're a Patreon member, you got to hear the explanation of why we don't edit around here. So this is a non-edited show.
Non-edited, folks.
So there's no live wire for our guest, who is, this is her first time on We Are Libertarians, Z Hunt. Z, how are you?
I'm doing so good. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You have, I've known your mom for a long time.
She's great.
She's a very nice woman. I met her for the first time. I've been Facebook friends with her for probably a decade. You know, I just knew her as this woman who had a litter of kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for sure.
So you have how many brothers and sisters?
So there are 11 of us all together.
Okay, mm-hmm. Including you.
Yeah, including, so I guess I have 10 brothers and sisters. Yeah.
Okay, so are we going to go for one more so we can get a full dozen?
You know, so the problem with that is that if you get twins and you've got an ugly number of like 13.
Baker's dozen, though.
Right, a baker. How ugly is that? 13? Oh, my. No, I'm just kidding. I love the kids. But no, so we're... 11 altogether. I think that's it, actually.
Is that like the first thing that people talk to you about?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much, yeah, it's really just, that's all I've got. So I'm going to go ahead and get off the show now.
All right, it's nice to have you here. All right, thanks for joining us. I guess I'm doing this one by myself. No. So are you already annoyed because I've already brought up the brothers and sisters?
No, I love big families. Like, honestly, I could talk about those for, like, forever. So
I actually met your sister first. Her name's Reagan. Is that after the president?
Yep, after Ronald Reagan.
And where was this going? And she's like, yeah, I want to have a dozen. I want to beat my mom. I was like, whoa.
She was like, that's my starter pack.
That's right. So your mom I've known for a long time. And then I saw her children start going to Mises events. And I started plotting. I'm like, all right, once these kids are in college, we're going to start putting these on them on the air here. Because they're 45 minutes south of here. And so we've got young libertarians that you really were indoctrinated, were you not?
It It really, yeah, it was kind of an indoctrination, you know, because when you grow up in a family, like such a large family, and then your parents are both pretty libertarian, and I've been going to events, so my mom would bring us four oldest girls. Well, I guess us three oldest girls at the time, she would bring us to different like talking events ever since we were maybe 12.
Well, that's where I met. I probably met you, and let's see if you were there. So I met several girls who were kind of older and some babies in strollers. I met your mom for the first time at Glenn Greenwald was speaking, and who else? Bruce Fine. So this is probably 2011.
I was probably there. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it was at IUPUI.
Uh-huh.
So we did meet in person then. We've met before.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah. This is great. Okay. Cool.
Yeah. And then I met you again at Students for Liberty. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you go to like a ton of, you travel more than I do, which I don't know how it's possible, but.
yeah, you're out all the time.
I know. So what libertarian events have you gone to as a college student or as a young libertarian?
So it kind of started, I think, with International Students for Liberty, which was their, just their convention in D.C.
Right.
Because when I got to campus, I went to St. Olaf College in Minnesota, and when I got to campus and I saw they had a Young Americans for Liberty group, I was like so excited. I was like, oh my God, you guys are here. We're so excited. and then so I started going to meetings right away. And then in the fall, we all decided, there was a pretty large group of five of us libertarians on campus. And so we decided... like pretty fiercely liberal campus. So we were holding together. But we ended up going to the DC conference, and that's kind of where all these different events started for me. Cause it was so inspiring, like all sorts of really cool speakers, very values based, which is what we get in libertarianism, which is awesome. And yeah, so I heard a bunch of cool speakers, and then I got to know the Mises Institute through that event too. And so there was a guy there representing the Mises Institute. He was awesome, so cool, and he was like, "Oh, you should totally come to our Mises University summer camp that we have." And so I applied and got in, and that's where it started with Mises events.
You're telling me there's a libertarian summer camp?
There is. So it's actually it's not literally labeled a libertarian summer camp, but it's called the Mises University, and it studies it's where everyone's studying Austrian econ. And so
nerd.
Yeah, it was so fun though. Oh my gosh. So that's my school of thought. Austrian economics is my thing.
Now
so.
Listeners know that I struggle with economics. I got a C in high school in economics, and yes, I know it's the foundation of everything that we believe. So I try my best. I read, I'm in the process of reading Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell.
That's a great one.
It is. It's very good.
I love Thomas Sowell.
You were on the beach reading what?
Rothbard. Okay. So Rothbard is my beach read. I have like a couple of Rothbard books that I've been wanting to get through. And, if y'all haven't read Murray Rothbard, he is, by far one of my favorite Austrian economists for sure.
Why?
Because he's very accessible. Like the way he writes stuff is just very laid out. I feel like people are going to fight me on this, but I feel like he's better than Mises in a lot of ways because he's more accessible to the layman, you know? Like just
you
anyone.
Just lost half the audience.
I know.
First appearance, and you're already stirring up controversy.
You're like, cool, I will never have you back.
I could care less. I read Rothbard because I do a subject topic-based show, and then I'm like, all right, what does Rothbard say about this?
Uh-huh.
So it's always like going back to, he's I don't want to say the Bible because he's not sacred, that's for sure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he is very authoritative, and so when you go to Libertarian Summer Camp, what is, like, how steeped in Austrian economics are you? Like, one of the founders of this show is Creighton Harrington, and he was in Young Americans for Liberty, and he could quote Rothbard right off the top of his head. Like, and he didn't even go to summer camp. You just must like dream about Hayek and.
I know. That's all I think about most of the time. Yeah. So it's not, it's very, very steep in Austrian econ. This particular conference event is because it's 7 days of just econ classes pretty much.
Okay.
And so all day long you were hearing from some of the brightest minds in Austrian econ. And it's free. Like you go totally on scholarship. They pay for your food, everything. You get to have lunch with people like Judge Napolitano, Tom Woods, Robert Murphy, and just casually talk to them. Like I was at Chipotle with Tom Woods, like just chatting with him, like, oh, what are you getting for lunch? Oh, me
what
too.
Does Tom Woods order?
You know, I forget forget. I was too busy thinking about how I was talking to Tom Woods at the Chipotle. So I was like, oh my God, hello.
How surreal is it? It must be so surreal for Tom Woods to like have college students go, I'm having lunch with Tom Woods. Like, what in what world are economist rock stars? It's amazing.
So funniest thing is that I was so still obsessed with Robert Murphy, and he is just like, I love the way he talks about things and how he explains things. And I remember seeing him when I was in high school, and I just had the best time watching him speak. And then I saw him at Mises University, and I was like, oh my God, it's Robert guys, it's Bob Murphy. And they were like, what, who's? And I was like, it's Bob Murphy, guys, you don't understand, but he's great. I'm so excited. And then he literally gets up and goes, because I was scared to go take photos with, you know, to go ask for photos with an economist. Like, who does that?
Right.
And then he was like,
somehow, you know, I imagine they said yes.
They were like, no, I don't have time for you. No, they're totally, no, they were like, oh yeah, of course. But he gets up on stage and was like, you know, I just want you guys to know, you know, we like taking photos with the students. It's not often we get to,
right.
We have like our fan clubs here going, so.
Yeah, they're everybody hates them everywhere else. That's the great thing. That's the great thing about going to libertarian events, be it a convention, a local meetup, a summer camp, which still blows my mind. I literally had no idea that this happened until I've been in the libertarian movement a decade.
Ostrian Econ summer camp, yeah.
Now, what was the guy to girl ratio, by the way?
Okay, so it was.
Do they have armed guards outside your door?
Yeah, like special padlocks on the girls' doors. Like, yeah, no, so it was. Could you know, there were probably like 8 to 11 girls there. So when I first, it's really gone up in numbers. I think we were like 20 something girls this year. I've been going for 3 years, but
okay.
The first year I went, there were like 11 girls and then like 120 guys. And so, yeah, good times. It was just really great.
That didn't seem all that sincere. I'm going to be honest with you.
No, I mean, someone said, oh no, this is mean. No,
no, it's okay.
Someone
we do.
Was like,
we're a fan of mean here. Go
so
ahead.
I have my like thinking voice and my, you know, like talking voice are different sometimes. But no, someone was like, yeah, man, the odds are good here, but the goods are odd. You know.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have never heard a better explanation of a woman at a libertarian event than that in my life. The odds are good, but the goods are odd. It is true. It is the creeper. How many friend requests did you get that weekend?
Oh, you know what? I don't even know. I got lots of all the friend requests. It was a good time, though. You know, just making friends, guys. Making friends. So.
Yeah, yeah, I bet. Yeah, that's cool. That's so. You read Rothbard for fun. I mean, you're gonna get a lot of friend. I mean, people are sitting here going, "Wow, the young libertarian who reads Rothbard for fun." I mean, they're furiously searching. That's why we're not using your real name.
That's right. That's Z Hunt, everyone.
Right, not the real one.
Not the real one.
So, but it is interesting how. So going back in my day, way back in 2008. I think for guys like Tom Woods or Ron Paul or you know, the people that I've been around, like Mark Rutherford or Andy Horning or some of the local guys too, it is really rewarding to see the growth. So I went to the Students for Liberty conference in 2013. It's now mm-hmm. called LibertyCon.
Yeah, I hate that new name.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it sounds like you're going to like an anime conference or something. You know, like right. It's bad enough being libertarian, but you know, no, I'm totally kidding.
I kind of agree with you. I think the visuals, the graphics of it are great. They've done a great job.
Yeah, no, it's really cool, yeah.
But we by nature don't like things that are hip or cool.
Mm-hmm.
Even the youngest of us. We're like, I want it a little bit stuffy. I want some David Friedman looking dudes walking
that's
around.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. Guys in suits. Yeah.
Right. Call it ISFCL or whatever. So I went in 2013 and it was not a ton of women. It was mm-mm. mostly guys. It was a lot of, you know, odd goods and they, you know, but I noticed a big shift away from political parties. So, you know, a decade before that, when I was in College Republicans, it was all about joining a political party. And I joined the College Republicans. I became president of my local chapter. We do things in college that we regret. One of mine was voting for Bush and having a pro-war rally and, you know, a lot of neocon stuff as a child. And, you know, so it, but then by 2013, because I went to CPAC in 2003, mm-hmm. and it was very party motivated.
Yeah.
And then in 2013, it was very candidate motivated. It was the era of Rand and Ron and Thomas Massey and Justin Amash. And then when I went this last year in 2018 to LibertyCon, it was 50-50 women. It was, in some respects, it was less about the philosophy and more about the personalities.
Right, yeah.
And I don't know if you have noticed this, but there is something going on in the youth movement of the libertarian movement where it is a little bit more about... It's become a little more poppy. It's become a little more reality TV-ized as opposed It's less about the philosophy. Those 2008 to 2012 y'all kids were really all about the Austrian economics. Mm-hmm. And the kids this year, a decade later, seem more about getting the photo with Thomas Massey.
Right, right.
Am I being overly critical?
No, I don't think that's overly critical at all. And actually, it's kind of funny because a friend of mine in college, I was president of Young Americans for Liberty my senior year, and she made this comment like, I guess being libertarian is like the hip thing to do now. And I was like, actually slightly offended. I was like, oh my God. I was like, no, I was in this before it was cool. Thank you very much. Like, like not into that. But, and it does seem to be less about the theory and the philosophy and like, that sort of thing, and definitely more about getting the pictures and, you know, having a good time and freedom for all, and, you know, lots of talk on the drug movement, lots of talk on, you know, like you've got all your like power words or whatever they're called. I forget, but yeah, so I agree.
Okay. It's a bummer, but
it's super sad
because what you end up with a Republican convention. I mean, everything that starts out, this is why I don't like protests. The first women's march or the first tea parties, they were all great.
Right, yeah.
But then it becomes, you know, the Tea Party Express is planning the rallies, the Move On people are planning the rallies. It becomes, and I think we're kind of moving that direction in the libertarian movement a little bit. You start to see the organizations taking over more than the grassroots, and that kind of can become an issue. Although I trust Fee and some of these other groups way more than I trust, you know, some of the others, but
right, it's true.
Conservatives, but
well, and this is what I love about the Mises Institute, and especially when I was there, like I totally felt like they were so steeped in theory and how, and like just a general philosophy of how they do things, that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't about being hip or cool. I mean, you sit and listen to hours and hours of lectures on Austrian economics, you know, like you're only there if you want to be there.
Right.
And so it's not like, oh, I'm going to go get my photo with, you know, Vermin Supreme and then call it quits, you know, which was actually very cool, guys, by the way. Right. Got a photo of Vermin Supreme. He was pretty cool. But not at Mises Institute, but yeah. So it's a lot less about, you know, the hip aspect of it and much more about the philosophy.
I still highly recommend it. I mean, what are some of your favorite memories from going to some of these events?
Oh, I loved hearing the speakers. There were some different sessions that particularly stood out to me that were really interesting. Especially they focus a lot. So for any college students who listen to the show, like they're a lot, like it's lots of focus on how the students can go about their campuses, about like kind of trigger issues on campus. So lots of sessions about that. That was cool. One of my favorite things that happened was there was a band who came from Russia, I think. And I don't know if they thought it was a Bernie rally or something, but they all wore Bernie shirts and they just loved Bernie. And but they were like literally like entertainment for the event. And you could tell everyone in the audience was super uncomfortable because they were like, oh, do these guys know they're like in the wrong place? Like, are they supposed to be here?
That's
like,
so funny. Was it Pussy Riot?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh.
That's amazing.
Isn't that funny? So they were all wearing Bernie shirts. Okay. So it was a good time. I mean, they were great. It was fun, but...
Yeah, so I think people think that it's really expensive to go to this stuff, so you've really just gotten scholarships and been able to pay... Other people have paid for you to go.
Yeah, so LibertyCon, they give like $100 travel scholarships. So it actually comes out to be super reasonable if you can book your hotels with other people.
Right.
And so, I mean, we were having, you know, don't tell the hotel, but we had like maybe six of us in a room at one time. So I mean, it works out just fine. Or you can Airbnb it. I'm into that now.
Yeah.
So yeah. So if you can drive or carpool, But the sucky thing is that if you're in school, you don't really have time to drive 10 hours.
Yeah.
So we usually flew, but that's fine too. You can fly, get cheap tickets.
I went to this year's, Rupert is actually speaking. Our buddy Rupert Bonham was speaking the 2019 Liberty Con. I'm debating going. I've got a place to crash, so I may go.
That's perfect.
But I had trouble getting there. I did a couple episodes there, but I walk in, I turn the corner to the convention, and the first thing I see is a Hunt sister.
Yeah.
I met you later, but I saw...
Lauren, probably.
Lauren.
Yeah.
It was not Reagan. It was somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah, it was Lauren, so she goes to the same school.
They're everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're now graduated from college.
Right.
But... what shift did you see from your freshman year to now in terms of, because in the beginning, in 2016, 2017, it was kind of like, all right, well, maybe Fire is just kind of overdoing it with the political right. correctness and the Antifa and the screaming and the safe spaces and all that. And now it just seems to be so pervasive and in our face. I mean, what kind of shift being on a liberal college campus did you see over those years? What years did you go to school?
So I was in school, from 2014, I guess, until now. And so it was odd because when it started, it seemed like it was a little bit less of a huge deal for people to, I don't know, there just weren't as many like die-ins is what we called them, or special riots for different school things. But the odd thing was for St. Olaf is that a lot of the administration tended to be a little bit on the conservative side, but the campus itself was just like very fiercely liberal. And actually, you know what, as a whole, if you were to poll the students, it probably wouldn't have been that, you know, left, like super, super left-minded, except the people who were on the very, very left tended to be more outspoken.
Right.
And so that's kind of where you got that. So in terms of a shift in 4 years, I definitely saw a lot more people come out of the woodwork for better like political philosophy about stuff. And so a lot of people said, you know what, look, I think we're taking this too far, you know, calm down, that sort of thing. And a lot of people went the exact opposite way too. So it's kind of neat watching people come out and say things where they were actually started to say their opinions about stuff. People started showing up for more meetings. It turned into pretty much like a weekly rant session for a lot of people. You
so
know?
because they were so active, it activated a bunch of other people to start knowing what they believe.
To say, hey, look, this is ridiculous. Like, you know, I knew I kind of didn't agree with you, but now I'm really feeling it. You know, that sort of thing.
I'm feeling that way too. I mean, you know, I don't know if you. You know, I come from a conservative background,
mm-hmm.
and I'm a conservative person by nature, and it is true. Like libertarians always fight for lives that are far more interesting than their own.
Right.
We're not that exciting in terms of how our personal conduct. So it's not like a lot of people are out there going, I want to do all these things, and that's why I'm here. It's like, no, you're here just because you love freedom.
Right.
But so I don't know if you come from more of a conservative or liberal background, but it is I have felt myself over the last year, especially kind of get pulled. I feel the pull of trying to get into a certain camp. Like I have been called a left libertarian for mm-hmm. so long because my main issues are war. I'm anti-war. I'm pro prison reform. Pro,
yeah.
You know. But you see sort of the polarization, like it even starts to hit libertarians. You start to kind of drift back into the bias that you were born into
mm-hmm.
or that you originally had. I mean, have you noticed that yourself?
Yes. I think you do begin to start drifting that way. I mean, I grew up in a pretty conservative background.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
So let me ask it this way. The kids that you went to school with, you're probably mm-hmm. Facebook friends with all of those people.
Right, yeah.
Those people that you're on the front lines of Students for Liberty with, you all love libertarianism, you're all like at the camps and, you know, meeting Murray Rothbard's godson or whatever they do. And have you noticed those people start to go from anarcho-capitalist Rothbardians towards one side or the other?
No, I think they've actually shifted a little bit more towards having just a firmer, like even just more libertarianism in itself, like not so much the politics of it, but more of the philosophy behind it too. And so, but I think they tend to be more on the left side, like if they were to shift to one side. So, and it's odd watching people as they graduate college, because in college they might have been, you know, super liberal on everything, and you see a lot of people starting to shift, like a lot of those Facebook friends, like as soon as they pay their first taxes, yep,
they start to get more.
Yeah, everyone gets a mind a mindset shift is what I was trying to say.
Say it three times fast now.
Oh my God, no. I refuse.
Well, cool.
Don't tell me what to do.
Oh, wow. All right. It's like I'm married again.
Oh yeah, wow, okay.
I had flashbacks. It's like my own
PTSD.
Personal mind. Yeah, and the benefit for you is you're going to be able to see the college shifts over the next 40 years.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. Mm.
What's your youngest sibling?
So the youngest is 4 right now.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, so he's going to be in school when I'm, what, like 47? Yeah. So he's...
47 is what you said,
wait,
right?
Yes. Yeah, 47 is what I said. Yeah, that says it.
That's not... Is that a joke? I don't do math. Is that... So if you're 20...
Right, so I'd be... I'm 23.
Right.
And so... And then he's 4. Right? And then in 20 years... Well, I guess he'll be right out of college.
You will be. You'll be in your middle 40s.
I will.
How crazy is that?
I'll be like, back in my day, when I was in college.
You'll be ranting on a libertarian podcast. So, you know, listeners kind of know... It's not that I don't know economics. I know economics and I know the arguments. It's just it doesn't motivate me. And I do this show... You know, I've said it a million times. It's the Buckley theory of political commentary.
Mm-hmm.
You commentate on what makes you mad.
Yeah.
And what makes you passionate. And so when I look at it, I just kind of go, yeah, central planners being central planners. But this thing over here that everybody's talking about. But I do want to pay more attention to economics. And so I, you know, when I found out that she was going to Mises camps and all this, I was like, you know, let's talk about an economic issue. Let's talk about tariffs,
mm-hmm.
which is not something that we have really covered, but it has been a big issue over the course of the last, gosh, really 3 years. I mean,
yeah,
it kind of is. It's crazy to me that we are talking about tariffs. What is it? 1932. You were telling me, you're like, I was like, what are you interested in? You're like, I really get into the history of tariffs. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, you're totally outing me on my nerdiness with this. So. I was like, oh my God, can we talk about history?
Don't blame me.
Okay. Right, everyone, put on your sleeping mask. It's time to...
No, so let's talk about the history of tariffs. Let's go all the way. I mean, how far back do you want to go?
Let's just go back to just kind of right when they started, right when they were implemented initially. What should I say about them?
Let's go back to Adam Smith. Let's go that far back.
Oh my gosh, that's pretty far back.
Well, I mean, in the early days, tariffs were really how most countries funded mm-hmm. a lot of their they taxed goods based on tariffs, because it was very easy at the beginning to say, okay, well, this shipment of stuff is coming in here. Let's put some tax on this tea.
Right, right.
Or let's put a tax on this paper, you know, because when you unload it off of the docks, we can mark it down on the manifest. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the good that is coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were telling me a crazy stat about the tariffs then in America versus now. I mean, what was that stat?
Yeah, so it's nuts, because when tariffs first started, so back in, in the U.S., so our first tariff was implemented in 1789, I think. And so that was right after we were done fighting a war off of taxes, partly. And so you got the federal government going, well, crap, we can't, you know, just pleasantly request taxes from the states, you know. So what's easy, the easy thing to do is to take, you know, taxes off of the shipments that are coming in, like you were saying.
Right.
And so that ended up being, I want to say roughly about 95% of federal income was tariffs for a while.
Hmm.
I mean, it went up and down. If you look at the numbers, I mean, it fluctuated quite a bit. But yeah, at certain points, it was like 95% of our income was from tariffs. But the interesting is, though, is that now it's only, what, like 1.2%, 1.4% right. of our federal income.
We're arguing over a very small amount of, but it still does have a great impact.
It's considerable, right. And the reason why it has such a big impact is partly because it affects other economic things within this country. But then in addition to that, it's our foreign relations. So we've got, you know, like the World Trade Organization on our backs. We've got, you know, like all sorts of trade agreements with other countries, you know, trade wars, stuff like that. So it does make a difference, even though it's only a tiny percentage of what we're doing. So
sure, yeah. And Adam Smith basically said that this is the tool of central planners, and he basically explained it in terms of chess. Mm-hmm. So a central planner will sit down and will look at the chessboard and put a tariff here on this thing and put a tariff here on this thing. So, for instance, the Chinese put a tariff on soybeans to hurt Trump in specific districts where he had the most support. So they're trying to affect our elections by putting tariffs on certain districts. Mm-hmm. And that has an effect. And so the central planner looks at it and says, I will put a 10% tariff on this, and this will be the outcome. This will be the thing. But the problem is that it's flesh and blood human beings. It's not necessarily, it's not chess pieces.
Uh-huh.
And so when you put a tariff on something like soybeans, what you end up with is subsidies. Mm-hmm. You end up with, it's the gateway to welfare. So you put this tax on soybeans, and then all of a sudden, Donald Trump is putting $12 billion in welfare into the pockets of soybean farmers. Mm-hmm. And so that always be, and then you get the retaliation, and then it just goes on from there, and it continues to build and build. And so that's the problem with using a tariff. Just to define a tariff, thanks to Zach Ripple for helping us with some research for this episode, part of our research team. What are tariffs? A tariff is a tax imposed by one country against an imported good from another country. Tariffs are usually levied against a specific good. There are two types of tariffs. Specific tariffs, a tariff employed against one type of good at a fixed mm-hmm. fee, unique to that good, for example. India places a specific tariff of $3 per pair of shoes imported from the U.S. So they put $3 per shoe. So the people in India are basically paying $3 extra for their shoes. Mm-hmm. Or there is the ad valorem tariff. These tariffs are percentage based on the value of the good. For example, this is a funny example, Zach. I was like, Biafra. For example,
I was like, is that a country? And then again, my meme history going down the.
I thought it was maybe a probiotic. So Biafra places a 10% tariff on vehicles from Kekistan, which I don't think is a real country either. I think he's messing with me.
He's just screwing with you. Yes.
So I think he's making up the example. Biafra places a 10% tariff on vehicles from Kekistan. That means 10% of the vehicle's good, vehicle's value. So a $10,000 car would have a tariff of $1,000 to import. So that 10% starts sliding. So you have the specific tariff of the set dollar amount, or you have the percentage tariff. And so there are non-tariff import controls such as import quotas, licenses, voluntary export restraints, or VERs. Mm-hmm. So there's several reasons that a country will use tariffs, and it usually starts with national security. And to me, this is having, back in my day. Back in my day, which was, you know, 2000 to the current era, I remember when politicians didn't use national security for literally every single thing. Mm-hmm. And then we went through the Bush era and the 9/11 era, and then national security became the excuse, and now it's overdone. It's you know, it's like crying at the Oscars, we roll our eyes. National security, so a country will limit an imported supply of good critical to national security, such as uranium, in favor of domestically produced goods. And basically, we want to decrease a country's reliance on imports for national defense. Mm-hmm. So you want to spur on a country. You know, so Trump says, I'm going to tariff the steel industry so we can grow the amount of steel being produced here, because it's in our national interest to have steel produced here. So if China gets out of sorts or Russia gets out of sorts, then we're not reliant on another nation's import. Protection of an infant industry. This is something you've seen solar panels tariffed like crazy over the years. Steel and solar panels are always like the first to be tariffed, starting in 2002. There is the protection of domestic employment and or consumers. So,
America.
Yeah, exactly. We're protecting those steel workers and their jobs. But the problem with that is inevitably you end up losing jobs in other sectors mm-hmm. because you're protecting those jobs. And then there's retaliation where a country like Saudi Arabia does something. So we put a tariff on their oil until they act in compliance with our wishes. So all of this is known as protectionism. And if you go back in to the history of our country, you start to see that tariffs were, it was very laissez-faire. Mm-hmm. That was the point of the Constitution. If you go back into the Articles of Confederation, part of the reason that that didn't work was protectionism. You had different currencies, and so you had currency battles between the states, mm-hmm. and then you had tariffs in various industries amongst the states, and that was one of the reasons that the Constitution was necessary to set up a situation where Florida could trade with North Carolina, could trade with South Carolina, and you had the free flow of goods, and that's part of the reason that America became America. Mm-hmm. Now, so these trade imbalances are talked about a lot. I just went to Florida. You just went to Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just got back like 2 days ago.
So how much would you say you spent in Mexico?
Oh, like on food and stuff?
Yeah, just in general. Let's throw out a number. What was the...
So let's say like $350 or something.
Okay. So you have a trade deficit with Mexico of $350.
I hate them.
Right.
No, I'm joking.
Yeah, exactly.
They're the worst.
So you have this trade deficit with this foreign country. I mm-hmm. have a trade deficit with Florida. I just went and spent $500 in Florida. Mm-hmm. And so, but the reality is I got goods and services in those countries. Did you get fed for your $350?
I did. It was delicious tacos. Ooh.
Right. Mm. Did you get housing while you were there?
I did. Right. Yeah.
So on paper, you have this trade imbalance with Mexico because the intangibles can't be seen on a balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So that is the ridiculousness of that argument. I want to, and sorry for being so chatty, Z, but...
oh, no, talk away. You're
good. I'm on a roll now. I'm fired up.
It's on a roll now, guys. All right.
So Cato has a magazine called Regulation, and it's a great magazine.
Ooh, you want that.
I'll show you all the different journals that I subscribe to.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'm in.
You will go home, and you will spend $500 on
That's
journals.
Right. I will have a trade deficit with my...
With Cato, yes.
Cato.
Yeah, Cato has several publications. You know, Regulation, they have their Cato Journal... There's Independent Institute, Hoover Institution, lots of great journals out there. I even take the Foreign Affairs from the Council on Foreign Relations because I like to taunt you people so you'll think that I am a globalist. So they have an article about Peter Navarro, and they talk about the trade deficit argument and the absolute, let's say dishonesty about Peter Navarro's trade deficit argument. And Peter Navarro is one of the few economists that actually works in the upper echelons of the Trump administration. He is a protectionist, and he is kind of the architect of all of this protectionism that Trump pushes. And so they write in this article, which is the actual front of the front page, Peter Navarro's conversion, because Navarro started out as a free trade economist and then turned into a protectionist.
Oh, so sad.
I know. And so they write, in the coming China wars, Navarro subliminally suggests that China is to blame for the federal budget deficit because the Chinese buy treasury bonds. Over the past 5 decades, the United States government has proven that it is quite able to run growing budget deficits by itself, which in turn invites trade deficits. As of May 2018, Chinese holdings of treasury bonds, no doubt mostly by the Chinese government, correspond to 7.7% of the federal debt. Contrary to what Navarro argues, the automatic adjustment mechanisms exist for trade imbalances. A trade deficit can grow larger than the net inward capital flows. Let me say that again because I didn't read it right. A trade deficit can't grow larger than the net inward capital flows. If it does, exchange rates will adjust. In the case of the United States, the dollar will lose value relative to other currencies, which in turn will reduce imports and increase exports. Mm. But foreign investors do want to invest in the attractive American economy. Navarro falls for the journalistic canard that net exports, exports minus imports, reduced GDP by simple arithmetic. When the expression net exports is used, it is usually written in quotation marks as Navarro and Autry do in Death by China, because it represents a mere statistical trick used by national statisticians to remove imports that were already included in the uses of GDP in consumer, government, and investment expenditures. Imports have to be removed because they are not part of the GDP, which is gross domestic product. Think about the guy on the scale who subtracts 1 pound to factor in the weight of his shoes. His weight doesn't change if instead he subtracts 2 pounds because the day he was wearing heavier shoes. Likewise, American output doesn't change because more imports are both added and subtracted. But Navarro and Autry overlook this when, in Death by China, they quickly drop the warning quotation marks around net exports and substitute trade deficit. Hocus pocus. They can now claim that the trade deficit reduces domestic production as a matter of accounting arithmetic. With all due respect to Navarro, George Mason University economist Don Boudreau was right when he posted on Facebook, "If Trump advisor Peter Navarro knows any economics, he's very skilled at giving no evidence to this knowledge." And so that's what the trade deficit is when these guys talk about the trade deficit, their arithmetic is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you can't really fall for some of this this nonsense from Peter Navarro. And this article in Regulation, I'll see if I can find it online, but you may have to buy the magazine yourself for $6.95 from the Cato Institute. And I'll see if I can link that in the show notes for you. But it just outlines all of the different arguments that Peter Navarro makes and just destroys them with real economics. Mm-hmm. That you learned at summer camp.
Yeah, my summer camp econ, back in band camp.
So what are some of the arguments that you've heard over the years about the trade deficit and why it doesn't make sense?
So I think there are a lot of good ones for why it doesn't make sense. I think some of the main ones are, one I really liked is that people always talk about infant industries and they say, well, like we got to have the tariffs because we've got to protect, you know, like American industry, and we've got to allow the U.S. to, you know, develop its own systems. And how can we do that if it's cheaper to import it from China? That sort of thing. And it seems ridiculous because we don't set a time limit on that. Right. So it's not like we go, oh, you know, in exactly 2 years, we'll cut the tariff off and, you know, then it's all everyone for themselves. You know, it's like no, you're going to have higher prices for maybe the next 80 years, maybe the next 90 years. No one knows. And if you said it that way, people probably wouldn't be all in for that.
Right.
You know, but they don't. They go, oh, it's a temporary, you know, it's like a temporary tax, you know, no problem, you know. So, and then it ends up lasting for a long time.
Right.
And so they just never put a time frame on it. So
yeah.
I think none is better, but time frame would be nice too.
Right. Another example could be the grocery store. This is mm-hmm. one that's often said. So I am a purveyor of spoken word here. And so let's say the grocery store, we look at the specific grocery store, and I go in and I buy $50 worth of groceries. And they have bought nothing from We Are Libertarians.
Right.
It doesn't mean that even though there is a trade deficit with that specific entity, it doesn't mean that I have lost anything.
Mm-hmm.
On paper, yes, I've lost, and they may have made profit off of me, but that profit then will be used to help support the system elsewhere. So
right.
The trade deficit is just really something that is not a very convincing argument when you start to break it down and look at it from an economic perspective. That's why very few economists are actually protectionist economists. Mm-hmm. They're sort of there's a lot more Keynesians, and we know how I mean, when I say Keynes, I mean, you must just get real irate about it.
I do. I get a little bit you're like, a little salty.
You're turning green. You're about to.
I am. I'm like, all right, cool. Let me at him.
Hulk smash.
That's right. Or trigger words.
So, and you listen, you jump in anytime because I talk a lot. So.
Right. I mean, it does seem like the argument for In terms of reducing the trade deficit. You know, when you hear it at first, you know, around the dinner table, you're like, oh, that makes sense, you know, reduce the trade deficit. But then in reality, it's just so bogus when you think about the amount of surpluses and deficits we have with just a bunch of varying countries.
Right.
And so yeah, we might have trade deficits, large trade deficits with some countries, but then we also have surpluses with others. And so money keeps circling around. So it's all good here, folks.
So let's talk about jobs being lost.
Jerbs.
Sorry. Wait, you were allowed to watch South Park?
I love South Park. Actually, you know, it's not that I was allowed to in high school. It's just that I did.
I sent this link to your mother. You might be grounded when you go home.
Oh, no. No, I'm moving out. I'm moving to Malaysia, so we're good.
What? Is that a joke?
No, I'm actually moving January 1st, so...
To Malaysia?
Uh-huh, to Malaysia. So, the 10 months.
The Creepertarians got to you that much, huh?
That's right. I was like, oh, my God, I gotta get away.
I can't get away from these Creepertarians. I've got to go to Malaysia.
That's right.
Well, that's very good. So, I'm feigning that I didn't know this. You're going to teach English to Malaysians? Is that
what
it was? All right.
To small Malaysian children.
All right.
So, I hope they're small. I hope they're not high schoolers. So
why?
Well, because high schoolers, I can't demand the same kind of respect as I can with small children.
You're much larger than a toddler.
Right. High schoolers are like, oh, we're just friends, you know?
So when it comes to lost jobs, the steel tariffs that Bush put in 2002 in place actually cost the steel industry 200,000 jobs.
Yeah.
And every single time that jobs are implemented, they're lost. So in this specific, let me see if I can find, you know, let me tell you what Trump is up to. Just looking at the Wikipedia page for Trump tariffs, you just have to Wikipedia it.
Yeah.
So
the best kind.
Exactly.
How many pages are there on Trump's tariffs?
This is a 16-page document.
Wow.
Yeah, there's
a
lot.
That's pretty.
But I also have a bigger font because I'm elderly.
Uh-huh. Right. Pull out the glasses.
So when you start to when you look at something like the Whirlpool, when the Carrier Corporation, Carrier was based here in India, and these jobs were lost. And so then Trump does the tax cuts, and Carrier's like, yay, we're going to stay. And then he does the tariffs on washing machines, and then ends up Carrier. When he did the washing machine tariffs, Carrier was like, yes, this is great. We can maintain jobs. But then he did steel tariffs in a second round, and then they had to move their jobs to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the Kentucky bourbon tariffs, 95% of bourbon is made in Kentucky. Well, Thomas Massie was talking about how in his district, he has a bourbon maker that is owned by a European Union-based company. And so when they placed bourbon tariffs to hurt Trump in Kentucky, the EU placed tariffs on the bourbon industry. The EU was taxing its own company, basically. It was making it more expensive for not only them, but also us.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you see when you place tariffs is that it never stops with just that one tariff. It never stops with just the washing machines. It then goes to the other country doing a tariff, and then you do a tariff back, and then there's another tariff,
mm-hmm.
and then it just is an escalating, continuing war. In the process, it's cronyism.
Yeah.
Thousands, tens of, almost 10,000 exemptions have been placed, have been filed by companies to get exemptions from tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you get countries that get exempted from tariffs. Australia got an exemption on the steel because they make a special type of steel. And so what you have with tariffs is that you end up with a tremendous amount of cronyism where you have countries and companies alike getting special favors from the government. And who loses?
Mm-hmm.
The people that are not connected, that are not donating to Congress, and consumers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so the higher prices for goods and the hit, the higher prices to do business, if you're involved in making washing machines and then someone places a steel tariff, it's more expensive to then make that washing machine.
Right.
And so what happens when you tax a business? What happens when you tax a business? Where does the money come from, Z?
The consumer.
That's right. Wait a minute. The business pays the taxes.
Right, right. But then the consumer has to pay the extra cost for whatever the service is, or maybe the products, or what have you.
It comes from it comes from three places. It comes from you paying higher prices, which often they don't want to do, because then they don't want to price themselves out of competition. They take it out of their stock prices, which they don't want to do because they want more investment, or they take it out of the labor market. And so they hire less people, they don't replace new workers, they don't give higher wage increases. And so the problem with Donald Trump's economic plan is that Donald Trump he spurred all this growth, all this investment from companies when he did the tax cuts, and then did the tariffs, and basically negated what he had done in a lot of these industries. Mm-hmm. And so he's losing American jobs, which he doesn't seem to be all that mad about, because in the end, there's too many jobs. too many jobs, Z. Too much work out there.
No, it's crazy, because it's like for the steel companies, say, I mean, because that's been a hot topic lately. You got our steel companies, and it's like they're getting a sweet handout from the government because, oh, awesome, cool. Now everyone has to buy steel from us in the United States, America. Right. And then everyone else who uses steel in their products, they suffer for it. Right. And so at a glance, too, you're looking at it, and again, you go, oh, cool, yeah, it looks like we have more jobs in the steel industry. And that's true, except when you look further than that and actually think about the repercussions of certain policies on just the average consumer, you know. And a lot of people go, well, yeah, I'm willing to pay an extra 10 cents on my, you know, this or that. Because, you know, I'm happy that steel is made in America in case we get times of war, blah, 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 all that stuff. But 10, you know, like a few cents on every product that some of these companies make, like that's huge.
Yeah.
You know, that's not just like, that's not pocket change when you're talking about thousands and thousands of products, you know. So it's ridiculous.
Especially in a global market. When you have a global market like we do, it is really hard to start picking and choosing winners and losers.
Uh-huh.
And so from a libertarian free market perspective, you have to look at these Republicans that are making these arguments and go, why are you engaged in crony capitalism? This protectionism is just basically the government picking winners and losers. Mm-hmm. It's giving welfare to farmers to the tune of $12 billion. It is, you have the power of the purse at Congress, and yet the administration, the executive branch, is choosing to activate a program. That farmer bailout to the tune of $12 billion to the soybean farmers is being funneled through an existing program that was started during the FDR Great Depression era. And so instead of the Congress voting to send the, according to the Constitution, $12 billion to farmers, it's Donald Trump just deciding to do this. And so from a constitutional limited government perspective, it's wrong. There just aren't a lot of really good arguments for free trade for, or for protectionism from a free trade from our show notes again from Zach, pro free trade arguments. There's, when you don't have tariffs, you have less bureaucratic interference. Bureaucracy automatically starts messing everything up. Do you deal with government bureaucracy? How does it go for you?
You know, not usually really well. not well.
No hindrance of commodity imports, so it's easier to import commodities. I imagine that you are familiar with iPencil.
Yes.
Can you explain what iPencil is?
So iPencil is like a little booklet kind of story thing that talks about like the creation of a pencil. And it's something that you would go like, oh, this is such a small thing and kind of a non-important object. But when you look at, you know, the amount of work that goes into creating a pencil and the amount of economies that are involved in that, it's kind of crazy. So it's like a 10-page read. It's super tiny.
Leonard Reed from just Google FEE and iPencil. And they talk about the rubber tree plants in South America or to the Congo, and you have zinc, you have wood, you have all these different things that just make up this tiny little pencil. And that's how the global economy works now, is that people in China are better at producing the actual physical good of the iPhone. But
is it going?
Yeah. So
woohoo!
Listen, that we were so fire.
Yeah, that was going. It was going well.
That we blew up the electricity for the entire apartment. So we're currently sitting here in the dark.
All right, you're about to hear some angry knocks on your door. Like,
please
crap
stop
here.
Dropping so much knowledge so hard. So I don't even. What were we even talking about?
Something about jobs, probably. Something about. I don't know. You know what? Something I wanted to talk about.
Yes.
The national security issue,
okay,
with the tariffs, because I feel like this is a huge that this is something that a lot of, especially like alt-right people, get at when
right.
they talk about what they like about tariffs. And they say, oh, you know, tariffs are great because what we're finding is that, you know, it helps protect our country in times of war. We'll have our steel production available, all sorts of stuff like that. But it seems to me that you know, again, so many of these arguments sound like a good argument at the face
right.
of everything. But when you dig a little bit deeper into it, it doesn't quite make sense,
right.
especially from a free market perspective when you're looking at it. So for the national security aspect, you know, you've got so say right now we're relying mostly on Chinese steel or we're relying mostly on imported steel. You know, like a lot of people, like you can kind of predict when times of war are going to happen.
Right.
You know, they don't just like, you don't just wake up in the morning and go, oh my, what? Like, what happened?
You know? What? I want to destroy that country.
Right. I'm going to, yeah, right.
Let me be honest though. Donald Trump might.
So right. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's not count our chickens before they're roosted.
I read something talking about Donald Trump and they were like, yeah, with his foreign policy, you know, it's kind of like leaving teenagers in the house alone for the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you expect it to be the house to be any cleaner when you come back or any better. You just hope it hasn't burned down, you
right
know?
Exactly right.
So but yeah, so you know, a lot of times you can kind of predict about when times of war would be, and from a free market perspective, and maybe this is something that people can dig at when they're, you know, when you're chatting with your friends about, you know, why tariffs are a bad idea, is that even with this whole idea of we're going to protect our country because we want to make sure that, you know, things are available to produce here, it does seem that if it were beneficial for, say, steel companies to have, you know, because prices of steel are going to skyrocket in times of war. So it seems like they would have the ability to transfer production to U.S. if they saw that there was going to be a good investment for that. And so I do think it would end up evening out for people where there is some sort of backup on U.S. soil because there's money in it.
In the global economy, I mean, different economies are better. And I remember what we were talking about. It's like what America is good at is designing the iPhone mm-hmm. and the code. And so America benefits by having those higher paying tech jobs. And
right.
there is pain as you move from the type of economy that you know, our parents grew up in to the type of economy, you know, where our grandparents grew up in less of a knowledge economy and more of a production economy. And so we are living in a knowledge economy. It's mm-hmm. it's beneficial for you and I, or for, wait, it's beneficial for you and me to, I had to think about it. I always get that one wrong. But so it's beneficial for us because we have higher wages. We have better paying jobs.
Right.
You know, and so the reality is that China's economy has a 1950s America economy. Mm-hmm. And so they're better at certain things than we are. And so there really isn't an enormous loss. If you go and look at people who lost their jobs, it's not like those people are, maybe these people in Michigan are being dumped onto the rolls of welfare, but by and large, I'm sure a lot of those people have transitioned into something different. The people who made the horse-drawn buggies eventually went to work in the auto industry. They took their knowledge mm-hmm. and they applied it to four wheels instead of two. Mm-hmm. And you look at the real competition for the American worker. I was watching some YouTube videos about this specific thing, and it was a John Stossel video, and he was showing Trump in Michigan talking about auto workers. It wasn't these cars being made in China.
Mm-hmm.
It was the cars being made by robots.
Mm-hmm.
So artificial intelligence and robotics are really the bigger competition for a lot of these low-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's incumbent upon people to increase their skill set in a global economy. And we're at the top of the heap because we have the ability to work at those higher-paying jobs mm-hmm. than maybe somebody who was born in the socioeconomic rung
in China, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to me, this is like the beauty, like just kind of the glory of human ingenuity in itself, because we have watched our economies grow and grow and grow or collapse in different ways. And we watch like people and their minds just like taking over that, you know, like you see a need in an economy and you fix that. Right. And so even if, say, you didn't have a job in one industry anymore, that doesn't mean that you can't get a job in another industry.
Right.
You know, like steelworkers didn't grow up being, you know, like you didn't grow up like being a steelworker. You know what I mean? It's like you find a profession, and then like because we have brains and like we know what we're doing, we can switch around, we can move.
Yeah, I will have 4 different careers in my lifetime.
Yeah,
and they'll all kind of be interconnected. But I've had 2 different careers already, mm-hmm. 3 different careers. You know, and so it's an ever building amount of skill sets, but it doesn't mean I think we just think about the economy. Donald Trump, especially, I think Donald Trump watches a lot of movies from the 1940s and 50s and 60s and thinks that's how the world should work. That's how we need to return to that world. And it just doesn't work like that. And there are just a certain amount of people that just can't get over the fact that their life is unfair and they're victims. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, it's like, quit living in the fact that this auto industry changed.
Right.
It is. It's different. And if those headphones aren't working, you don't have to wear them anymore.
Oh, okay.
They're not working.
They're not working. Okay.
Do you like avocados?
I love avocados. Well, actually, you know what? I like a little bit of avocado.
A little bit. Define a little bit of avocado.
Not like piles and piles of avocado, but like 4 bites, you know. Like
okay, that. 4 bites. All right. Growing up, I never saw an avocado. I never have. Did you know that there was a world where we did not have avocados?
What?
It's true. It's absolutely the truth. When I was a kid, avocados didn't exist.
Oh my gosh. Oh wow. Okay.
Well, they existed, but I just didn't see one until 1997.
Right, no, the trees didn't exist, guys. They had not made the trees yet.
The only reason that we have avocados in such great numbers is because of NAFTA, because of the free trade agreement in 1993, I think it was, with Bill Clinton and Mexico, where we were able to import avocados. Think of all the guacamole makers that we've been able to employ.
Think about how people's lives have been changed. Oh my God, guacamole.
Are you basic?
Pretty much, you know. I really try not to be, but
listen, it's okay, just admit it, you're basic,
you know. Thank you.
You like,
thank
you. You like avocado toast. You got like avocado toast. It's okay.
Right. And just a little bit on some low fat bread, that's how I like it, you know. Just
I just like ooties.
Just a little bit of avocado.
Ezekiel bread or bust.
That's right.
Ezekiel bread is not bread. I don't know what that is, but I will never put that in my mouth. If you have,
I love Ezekiel bread. I didn't know that was basic, though. I thought that was health nut, but I didn't know it was basic.
It's definitely health nut.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
I think I had it once, and it was like, it's like a weird texture. I just couldn't. I was just like, what in the?
So tasty, wholesome, wholesome.
So let's go to a Cato study from 19. From Daniel Griswold, this will be in the show notes, in 1998. This is 5 years after NAFTA was passed. Since the passage of NAFTA in 1993, the real gross domestic product of the United States has expanded by 12%, and civilian employment has grown by more than 8 million, including a net increase of 500,000 jobs in manufacturing. Inflation has remained subdued at 2 to 3%, thanks partly to the price competition of imports. The job losses that critics of free trade blame on NAFTA are mostly fictitious, based on the misuse of trade deficit numbers, which we've already established here is a complete misnomer. Mm. About 150,000 Americans have filed for benefits under a program for workers allegedly displaced by increased imports from Mexico and Canada. As painful as the displacement may be for those workers, the U.S. economy during the last 4 years has created that many net new jobs, approximately every 3 weeks. Nor has investment in the United States suffered since the passage of NAFTA. Total non-residential fixed investment in the United States has risen by one-third since 1993, from $600 billion to an annual rate of more than $800 billion so far in 1997. Investment in the U.S. last year included $77 billion in direct foreign investment, making the United States the number one destination in the world for foreign capital. In contrast, American direct investment in Mexico since the passage of NAFTA has averaged about $3 billion, or less than 0.5% of the capital invested in the U.S. during the same period. So much for a giant sucking sound. So this is, and you may, I don't know if there's an economic principle, but I've noticed in doing this show that the more availability of labor and capital and goods, the more economic growth there is.
Right, right.
I mean, is there an economic principle that says that, or is it just everybody knows that and I'm a dumbass?
No, I think there's for sure an economic principle for that. I do not remember the name for it. So,
Tom Woods failed.
I know. All right. I hope he hasn't listened to the show. Oh, my God.
I know he has listened, but probably not now.
Right. Good. All right. So, I'm safe. I just want to let everyone know.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the open borders argument. The more labor there is, the more jobs that will be filled. Mm-hmm. So, what are some other things that, as you were prepping, that you kind of wanted to talk about in terms of tariffs?
You know what? That's pretty much, that covers a lot of the things that I had initially wanted to talk about. I mean, they're pretty much just the three arguments that we went through, you know, like, does it actually reduce the trade deficit? Is it actually good for infant industries? Is it actually good for national security? So those are a few of the ones I had just pinpointed in my notes. Yeah, I think that's about good.
I think one of the final things that we ought to actually cover as we prep you for dealing with your boomer relatives at Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. Do you have boomers in your family?
I do. My grandpa. So he's a Vietnam War veteran. So he just, he's a hoot.
He's a hoot.
He's great. I love him.
Oh, boomers. So your parents are Gen X.
Yep. I guess so. Yeah.
How weird is it that there here's an adult that has graduated college sitting here with Gen X parents?
Oh my God! Well, yeah, it's pretty weird.
So are you millennial or you're millennial?
Yeah, I'd be considered millennial.
Yeah.
I think.
All right. Cool. Mm-hmm. You rule then. Not one of these lame Gen Z. Do you, you look at your Gen Z counterparts in your family and just go, I feel sorry for you.
I know. I'm like, ooh. Yeah, it's kind of strange. With such a large family, you've got different generations, like different classified generations of kids. So. So millennial, the youngest will be a Gen Z.
Are you the oldest?
I'm second oldest.
Okay. Is Reagan oldest?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. I'm the oldest of three.
Wow. Three kids. Wow.
Amateurs.
Amateurs. Wow. Oh, only three.
Wow. It's okay. So... One of the real problems with tariffs is the danger that it presents for the American population. So one of the unspoken causes, maybe not a lot of people think about it. People think, oh, the Great Depression was caused by greed. Well, no, the Great Depression really was pushed further and faster by tariffs, the Smoot-Hawley tariffs.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And so we talk, we go now to Thomas Sowell in 2005 in an article titled, Tariffs Didn't Work Then, Won't Work Now. He writes, most of the leading economists in the country were opposed. A front page headline in the New York Times of May 5th, 1930 read, 1,028 economists ask Hoover to veto the pending tariff bill. Those signing this public appeal against the new tariffs included many of the top economists of the day, 25 professors from Harvard, 26 at the University of Chicago, 28 at Columbia. But to a politician, what do 1,028 votes matter in a country the size of the United States? Rep. Hawley and Senator Smoot both ignored them, as did President Herbert Hoover, who signed the legislation into law the next month. The economic reasons for not restricting international trade then were the same as they are today. The only difference is that what happened then gives us a free home demonstration of what can be expected to happen if we go that route again. The Economist appeal spelled it out. The proponents of higher tariffs claim that the increase in rates will give work to the idle. This is not true. We cannot increase employment by restricting trade. Skyrocketing unemployment. If a 9% unemployment was troublesome in 1930 when the Hawley-Smoot tariff was passed, it was nothing compared to the 16% unemployment the next year and the 25% unemployment 2 years after that. The annual rate of unemployment in the U.S. never got back down to the 9% level again during the entire decade of the 30s. American industry as a whole operated at a loss for two consecutive years. Farmers who had given strong support to the Hawley-Smoot tariff saw their own exports cut by two-thirds as countries around the world retaliated against the American tariffs by restricting their imports of American industrial and agricultural products. The Economist appeal had warned of retaliatory tariffs that would set off a wave of international trade restrictions which would hurt all countries economically. After everything that these economists had warned about happened, tariffs began to be reduced, but throughout the 30s, they remained above where they were before the Hawley-Smoot tariffs, and so did unemployment. Many factors, of course, affected the Great Depression of the 30s, but later economists looking back have seen the Hawley-Smoot tariff as one of the factors needlessly prolonging the economic disaster. How much wiser are we today? Not much, if at all. And it seems to continue on in that vein. Mm-hmm. So,
gosh, I love Thomas Sowell.
He's awesome.
He's great.
I didn't really read a lot of Thomas Sowell until recently, and he's just so clear and well-spoken.
Right. Yeah. I love that man.
I guess I shouldn't say well-spoken. Is that racist of me to say well-spoken?
I don't know. Huh?
But I mean, for an economist to like make, like, I read economists, I'm just like, I don't get it. I'm like,
I know, yeah.
Is there anybody that you have trouble reading? Like, Hayek, to me, I'm just like, I gotta take my time with this.
Actually, Mises, I have, yeah, don't kill me, everyone, but, like, I do have trouble, like, with him sometimes. You know, like, you're reading, and then you're like, I gotta read that again.
Yeah.
So, it's a read and repeat, you know, kind of thing.
I think it's like, a generational English thing, too.
Yeah, it could be. I just didn't learn to read until, like, last year. No, I'm talking.
Well, you were homeschooled, you know?
Homeschooled.
So, did you like being homeschooled?
I loved it. It was really good. I thought it was a great experience. I got a lot of other opportunities out of homeschooling that I wouldn't have gotten in the public school system.
Really?
So I think there are a lot of perks to it. I was never in sports. Most clubs I was in was like chess club and debate.
Wow.
But I did get to take college level classes in high school, which was kind of fun. And got to graduate a year early and go live in Germany for a year. So that was also pretty chill. You know, there are a lot of things like different opportunities, trade-offs. And I would have traded, you know, playing soccer anytime to go to Germany for the year.
Yeah.
So, or to take college classes.
Which part of Germany?
Frankfurt.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. My people are from Würzburg.
It's big.
So, yeah. I mean, did you get to travel all around Europe? And
I did. I was all over the place. I did like a Euro tour. And then I spent a weekend in Finland. I was in, learned to ski in Switzerland. Went to England for a bit too. All sorts of places.
It's kind of annoying how fun your life is.
I just want to say my life is kind of cool. That's all I'm here for.
How have you been able to create these opportunities for yourself?
You know, it kind of, a lot of it spawned off of taking the gap year initially in high school. And things just kind of come up when you're looking for them. And the way I see opportunities for people is that it's like opportunities are out there for everyone. But you have to be like actively searching
right.
for them. And so after I got back from the gap year, I was like, oh, cool. Like now that I'm in college, I want to be sure I take another, you know, semester abroad. And then I took two Januaries off. I did one to go backpacking and then one to go work in India marketing for a company. And it was like those different opportunities kind of come up as they go. So,
but you have to kind of seek them out. And
right, you seek them out. Got some government grants to do some stuff. So that was kind of fun. Felt very conflicted taking those, but
you paid for it. It's like, there's a bunch of library books sitting over there and I pay for it. I'm going to use it.
I know. No, that's what I'm saying. I was like, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and take this. And you.
I always advocate libertarians should take every piece of government help. So to use it against them. Yeah, I think it's really cool that you have created a lot of these opportunities. I think people sometimes think that they just are going to come along, but I think people don't realize that you have to kind of generate your own stuff. You have to kind of be out there churning things and looking for opportunities and then taking the risk. I mean, just it takes guts to say I'm going to move to Malaysia or India or Germany. I mean, it's pretty cool. I mean, what is the mindset there where you're like, because I'm very much a comfort zone person. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I might be uncomfortable if I did that. I mean, what do you, when you're confronted with that choice of comfort versus adventure, I mean, what is that that goes on in your head?
I was just, I never a huge homebody. And so,
well, there was no room for you. You didn't have a couch. There was no TV. Like,
I don't even have a bed here.
I'm looking for any food.
That's right. You know, it's really hunger that really caused me to.
Right.
No, so, no, so it was, I forget where my train of thought was going. I was thinking about hunger.
Are you hungry?
No, I'm good. I'm good. It was the avocado thing that triggered me initially.
I can whip up four avocado pieces for you.
No, that's fine. No, so when you're thinking about, you know, do I do this or do I not, I kind of see it as like jumping into some cold water, you know, and it feels really good after you jump. But you just kind of go do it. Like I tend not to overthink trips too much, and so I booked a trip to Honduras in December to get my scuba license, but I probably shouldn't have done that. But I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna do it. And so I just bought the tickets, and that's just always what I do. I just buy the tickets and I plan it afterwards.
Yeah,
because if I get bogged down in like the details of like where am I gonna stay or what am I gonna eat,
yeah,
you know, you just get too distracted with everything.
It's so easy in the internet age. It's so easy to rent a car. It's so easy to get an Airbnb.
Right?
It's so easy to find a little hole in the wall restaurant with Yelp or it
no,
is.
It's so true.
It's like, and you don't, if you're gonna travel, it doesn't take. You don't need $1,000 that week. It's like, all right, you pay $250 for the Airbnb this month, and next month you pay $250 for the air, and then
right.
Yeah, you can kind of piece it all
out. No, it's so true. And I've been kind of, you know, getting stuff in different chunks for like the Honduras trip, or I just got back from Mexico, and that was a couple, you know, like, I don't know, you just kind of budget for it. You just kind of pick what you want to do and go for it.
Right.
So, yeah, I love it though. If I get bored, I look at plane tickets. It's really an unhealthy obsession, but it's, at least I don't like, you know, shop on TV or something. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
I
got, yeah, you just like live super simply so you can go and do these trips. So you like have like four pieces of clothing.
That's right. You know, I eat once a day. You know,
No, I was always afraid to travel, and then this year I traveled a bunch, and it is not that hard to do, and not as expensive as I thought.
Mm-mm.
And it is, it's fun. Like when I went from one in May, two in June, two in July, one in August. It's like I was so bored in September.
Yeah.
And then thank goodness I got to go to Orlando and Florida, and then now it's like I'm not going anywhere for a while. Partly because I'm like, I gotta like save my, build up my budget
for
again.
New car wheels.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. I got four of my tires stolen. But it is, it's kind of a cool experience, and especially when you're young and you don't have, don't think you have a husband or kids.
Nope.
All right.
I'm good on those two.
All right, not that you're aware of.
Right, as far as I know, I don't have a husband or kids.
Right.
You know,
it's pretty there's some Misesian kid going, no! That's funny. So how active do you want to be in politics?
Oh my word. You know, I think it's one of those things. I'm just like, I'm open to opportunities to be a part of things. But I haven't really thought a whole lot about it. And I think, goodness, you know, I've been so focused on like theory and econ the past, you know, 4 years-ish. And so I've never been super into the politics of it.
Right.
And part of the reason I hate it is because kind of like we were talking about earlier, is this whole movement towards just like the feeling of it, or just like the vibes of a movement, or, you know, right, how cool you look doing it, that sort of thing. And it really, I feel like it should be based on, you know, good philosophy. And like, how do you view human beings? Like, how does that reflect how you view their politics? You know, like what sort of responsibility do we expect people to have? And so if I could do politics in that way, I would be so down. But
I'm gonna just be honest, you can't. No. I mean,
right?
It's such a vain industry, and I think if you're a principled person, and I think this is why libertarians have so much trouble with all of it, is that if you're a principled person in a vain industry, it's very difficult.
Right.
And
right.
So because the vanity is what matters, and mm-hmm. So I could have been so much further ahead in my career had I been. It's not that I'm not a vain person. I mean, I guess...
it's not like I don't love myself.
I have my own vanities, but at the same time, it's like I'm not going to sacrifice certain things for my principles. Mm-hmm. But it is. It's kind of a bummer. I mean, so... All right. Well, let's give your final thoughts. So at the end, we do shameless self-promotion. We do final thoughts on the episode. Anything that you might have missed that you want to talk about in terms of tariffs, this is the time to do so.
Okay. You know what? I've got just a super random fun fact for you guys.
Okay.
So, you know, who collected the tariffs at the beginning when we first did tariffs? So Alexander Hamilton was like, oh, we got to have, you know, people to collect the tariffs. It was called the Revenue Cutter Service. Which sounded like a pretty cool name to me. But then it later got merged with the United States Coast Guard, which I didn't know.
Really?
And so, yeah. So that's just kind of a random fun fact. I was like, oh, the Coast Guard was the tariff police. That's sad.
The United Cutter Service is my favorite.
States Cutter Service.
Is my favorite indie
band. The Revenue Cutter Service. Yeah, yeah. It's pretty hip. The Revenue Cutters. Yeah.
Man, they 14 banjos. It's great. Yeah.
Pretty hip, guys. Everyone should listen.
All right. Any other final thoughts before we go?
No. You know what? I think we pretty much covered it. Covered a few basic arguments, why they're important now.
All right. All right. Well, yeah. I want to... So here's where we're at with the car. It is at the dealership. They're getting the tires.
Me. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. I've gotten a lot of messages. So this will kind of... Because people are curious. The insurance company and I don't think we're going to have to fight, but it almost got there on Friday. So it's all being taken care of. I'm at the point, and you're younger, so you're not there yet, but you just get to a point where you go, I pay you a lot of money. Stop making it difficult on me. I just learned a lesson with the tow, for instance, that you better document everything in your life. Like, you better take photos of everything. Mm-hmm. You better take video of things. You better protect yourself, because these companies that you pay a lot of money for, they're not really working for you. You got to kind of make sure that you're looking out for yourself. And I grew up in, I've always been a very much, it'll work out type person, but I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to start rolling tape on everything. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Rolling tape on it all, because if I didn't have some of the photos and videos that I had, it'd probably be a lot more complicated. So, thanks to Craig DaCosta, Jason Doolittle, Christy Avery, the Freedom Coalition, the Liberty Coalition, I'm sorry. I don't know why I do that. The Liberty Coalition for being our $100 a month subscribers. Everybody, thank you for joining us here on this episode of We're Libertarians. Still no power. We're still sitting here in the dark.
We're still out in the dark. So it's been fine, though. We're still conquering anyway.
It's been 27 minutes, and she's not tried to cannibalize me yet.
Right. So but I told you I was hungry.
We're not panicked yet.
Those avocados are in the kitchen, because I'm just...
there's a ripe avocado. I've got the stuff to make the guacamole for your avocado toast. All right. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you next week.